Good afternoon, everybody. Welcome to this Flint Global 56 degrees north briefing call, which we're hosting today on the very current topic of Scotland and the future of the UK Union. I'm your chair, Philip Ryecroft, a specialist partner at Flint Global. My background, I was a civil servant for 30 years, 20 years working in the Scottish Government and its predecessors, and 10 years in Whitehall with a major focus on constitutional and devolution issues alongside Brexit. This has been an important few days in Scottish politics. The SNP conference concluded earlier this week. The Supreme Court has begun its hearings on whether it is within the powers of the Scottish Parliament to hold a referendum on Scottish independence. And early next week, the Scottish Government will publish its paper on the economic case for independence, which is being long awaited. The purpose of this call is to give you an update on how we see things unfolding in Scottish politics over the next couple of years and what that means for the UK and for business, wherever you're based in the UK. And I'm really pleased to be joined this afternoon by Fiona Stanton and Anthony Thompson, both from our colleagues and partners at 56 Degrees North, based up in Scotland. I'll let them introduce themselves. Fiona, over to you to introduce yourself.
Hi everyone, Fiona Stanton. I'm a former Labour Party director, including as interim general secretary of the party in Scotland. I was heavily involved in Labour's campaigning in the 2014 referendum, and I'm also a director of Gordon Brown's think tank, Our Scottish Future.
Great, thanks, Fiona. Anthony.
Thanks, Philip. Good afternoon, everybody. I'm a public policy advisor. I previously led lobbying for the CBI in the UK and across Europe, and I've also got extensive experience in Scotland. I helped run planning for the 2014 referendum for both Lloyds Banking Group and TSB and Financial Services, and I've led engagement on finance and economic issues for a number of firms since the financial crisis in Scotland.
Great. Thanks, Anthony. So we're going to run this call in four sections. You'll get a brief overview from me. Then Anthony will take us through the position and mood of the SNP following their conference. Fiona will talk about the electoral politics of Scotland and the importance of Scotland for Labour as we contemplate the next UK general election. And Anthony and I will round off with a word about the implications for you in the business community. The call will last less than 30 minutes, so you should be back to your tasks within the 30 minutes. But anyway, let me kick off with an overview of the situation. So Scotland, in broad terms, is a nation divided. Polls over the last 2 years have shown a pretty consistent split, 50-50, between those who support the union and those who would vote for independence. Interesting to note that the most recent YouGov poll shows a big collapse in numbers intending to vote Conservative in the next general election, and confirmed that rough 50-50 split. So the future of Scotland in the UK Union remains very much in play. So why this level of support for independence? In my view, it's a combination of a belief that Scotland should be a self-governing nation, alongside a dislike and a distrust of UK governments. And Brexit has helped to consolidate support for independence. It's probably responsible for the 5% or so increase in support for independence since the 2014 referendum. And it is just worth noting that the support for independence is greater in younger age groups. So the YouGov poll, it's about 72% among 16 to 24-year-olds, 57% among 25 to 49-year-olds, and very much lower in older age groups. And despite the time since the 2014 referendum, and despite everything that's happened since then, there is no sign of that support for independence eroding substantially. Now, it's been the strategy of the UK government to appeal over the heads of the Scottish Government directly to the people of Scotland to make the case for the union. This is so-called muscular unionism, pushed through legislation like the Internal Market Act against opposition from the Scottish Government, take power to spend money in devolved areas of policy and build relationships directly with local authorities in Scotland. They've been doing a lot of that, but it has to be said, it hasn't shifted the dial notably in terms of opinion in Scotland. It's unclear whether the Truss government, obviously still trying to find its feet, has a thought-out approach to handling UK union issues. Responsibility for handling the union reverts to the Cabinet Office. Now Michael Gove is no longer Secretary of State at DLUC. Nadeem Sahawi is in charge. Truss herself took a pretty hard line in her leadership campaign, as you will remember, suggesting at one point that the best way of dealing with Nicola Sturgeon was to ignore her. And true to her word, she has yet to speak to Sturgeon since becoming Prime Minister, which is pretty unprecedented. I think there is a zero chance that the Truss government will accede to the Scottish government's demand for a second independence referendum next year, despite the fact there is a majority for independence in the Scottish Parliament. So that's why the Scottish government has asked the Supreme Court to opine on whether it has the powers to go ahead itself in terms of holding a referendum in Scotland without permission from Westminster. Those hearings, as I mentioned earlier, have begun. The court may decline actually to offer an opinion on that the basis that the question is speculative. If it does rule, most lawyers who are commenting on this think it is very unlikely that it will do so in favour of the Scottish government. So looking at this from that perspective, it is very unlikely indeed that there will be a legal referendum in Scotland on the SNP's preferred timetable, which is October next year. What does the SNP do about that? Anthony, you've been at the conference. Over to you to describe the mood in the SNP.
Thanks, Philip. I think I'll start by just reminding everybody that the SNP has been in power now for over 15 years in different makeups. And it's true to say they are caught in a bit of a pinch by being both the slightly tired incumbents in day-to-day governing in Scotland, but still the disruptors in Westminster. And as you outlined, Philip, if you base your analysis purely on the polls, they're actually balancing those two positions pretty well and maintaining support for their cause. In terms of the conference in Aberdeen, it was really interesting to watch on the ground. I mean, it was very clear that the party went into the conference wanting no drama. Right now, they want to be demonstrating unity to the outside world and rallying the party faithful behind their strategy for securing a referendum along the timetable that you've just outlined. And there really was a remarkable lack of debate on big domestic policy issues over the weekend in Aberdeen. It's worth remembering they are on the ground under real pressure on a range of issues, such as health, education, drugs policy, transport, so on. But there were no real debates of substance on any of those issues. And actually, the mood on the ground was one of quite strong unity, I would say, on the surface. But on the fringe, you could see some of the tensions emerging with activists. And again, it's worth remembering that having been so successful electorally over the last decade, the party now has over 450 councillors and they lead 13 councils in Scotland. And those councillors are increasingly taking out some of their frustrations on the Scottish government when they face problems delivering on their own local agendas. And if you combine that with some frustration about whether the leadership will move quickly enough for some activists on having another referendum, you can see that there are some tensions bubbling away under the surface. So this is why the First Minister and the SNP leadership came forward with their strategy for trying to secure a referendum in recent months. And the question of the day is whether that two-step strategy is going to be effective. Let's remember what the strategy is. Either holding a referendum on the back of a successful Supreme Court ruling. And Philip, you've given the view on the chances of that. And if that is unsuccessful, looking to move to a plan B, so to speak, of fighting the next general election as a de facto constitutional vote and the need to have a referendum. So the SNP leadership are saying that's the right strategy. They're also briefing that even if they don't win the arguments in the Supreme Court case, they have been feeling confident about maintaining their lead in future elections, hence the Plan B strategy. And the First Minister and her allies definitely feel the UK politics at the moment can play further into their hands. And John Swinney's speech was especially strong at the weekend about, he said, not taking any lectures from Conservative government on economic competence and stability. So they're definitely trying to play into that strand at the moment. But privately, the party knows that it is entering a critical phase in the debate with some really high stakes decisions to be made. And I would say right now that there is a lot being rested on this Plan B strategy of using the next general election as a de facto constitutional vote. Those close to the leadership are saying even if the SNP loses the court case, they're hopeful that the ruling will include helpful comments that will further the moral case for Scottish voters to have another say on the country's future. But there is really big focus on whether this is the right path to go. The First Minister, as I say, believes it is. And the recent polling that Philip has referenced suggests the SNP could actually increase their number of seats in Westminster. But obviously the big shift in those polls were around people's voting intention for Labour. SNP advisors who we speak to say that they believe that that shift has come entirely from Conservatives. And at most the polls suggest Labour securing 5 to 7 seats. But I think it's important. Most observers believe the moral argument will only be advanced if the SNP wins 50% or more of the vote in the next general election. That is a much higher bar. And I would say when you look at the YouGov data, their poll had 13% of people who voted SNP in the 2019 election and 18% who voted yes in 2014. Saying they intend to vote Labour at the next Westminster election. So there is some weakness in the polls. What can we expect? Well, first, everybody agrees that we're entering a critical phase in the debate. The SNP senses the next 2-3 years is likely to offer the best opportunity of securing their ultimate goal for some time to come. So it's really in the party's interest to keep ratcheting up the stakes. But we should also be alive to the party being flexible in their strategy. And they have demonstrated time and again their ability to campaign and strategize around campaigning in a very successful way. The First Minister wants to push for if the Supreme Court doesn't go their way. But it was interesting in her conference speech that she said if the Supreme Court case is unsuccessful, quote, we will respect that judgment, and as a party, we will reflect. Might suggest some flexibility in their strategy, but they are determined to bring this to the surface and to some kind of resolution in the next couple of years. They believe the turmoil surrounding Westminster opens up an opportunity to reposition the economic case for independence. And Philip's referenced the paper they plan to issue on Monday. The party see that as a really critical point at which they would like to engage with business. And we'll talk about that in a little while. And listening to the likes of Angus Robertson over the weekend, they also see the fragile economic picture presenting an opportunity to restate the party's case on restoring Scotland's EU membership. So I'll hand over to Fiona for more insight on Labour, but we'll pick up with Philip on what this all means for business. After Fiona's spoken.
Thanks, Anthony. My starter really is that Labour are very much taking Scotland seriously strategically. It's part of what I've described as the key four electoral building blocks to majority, along with regaining red wall seats from 2017 and 19, regains from 2010 and 2015, particularly in the Midlands, and real inroads in the South. Labour could conceivably win a general election without Scottish gains, but that would really have to hoover up the South to a degree that is 97 on steroids, really. But broadly, to make the minimal kind of 1, 2, 3 gains that they need, Labour needs ideally early double-digit gains in Scotland. And I'll come on into a minute to break that down a little bit. Labour are absolutely determined to avoid any suggestion of needing the SNP to get across the line. Starmer made that very clear in his conference speech. And sustaining the recent poll lead will make that challenge easier to navigate for sure. So no one serious within the party thinks that there's a route without Scotland. And those who do are increasingly isolated. There's always been two broad schools of thought with Labour post-2015. One, needing Scotland and commitment to resolving those challenges. And two, writing it off effectively and focusing on a perceived route through England. It doesn't need to be a zero-sum game, though, and recent changes in Lotto will see more focus in Scotland, I believe. The winning post of 3-2-6 becomes harder for Labour to reach for the new parliamentary boundaries, which favour the Conservatives in terms of population, but obviously wouldn't be a factor if the government falls before the boundaries are legislated upon. So what are Labour realistically hoping for in the next general election in Scotland? My take really is that the top end of their target is in the early 20 gains. But that I would say is very top target. The minimum is broadly the seats they lost in 2019, the 2017 gains. So on top of Edinburgh South, gains through maximising the unionist squeeze vote, for example, Kirkcaldy and Cowden beat East Lothian. Now that doesn't sound a lot, but it is a massive challenge. And to achieve even more, they need to start making gains against SNP-held seats. And realistically, an overall 7 to 12 gains here is a real achievement rather than a much higher early 20s. If Labour gain those kind of numbers, then they really will be on the path to Downing Street, but they'll also have done damage to the SNP cause. But it's a big if. And none of that changes the SNP winning a likely majority of Scottish seats and potentially vote share and seeking another referendum. Campaigners believe certainly that support for another vote just now is weak. Strategists we know tell us suggest support is stuck at 50% on a referendum vote in the next 5 years, and the numbers backing a vote in the next 2 years is even lower, although those numbers have been increasing recently. So how is Labour reading the uptake in the polls? Do they see it as a start of resurgence? Absolutely, there's a full understanding that there is a softness in the polls, but the longer they remain ahead, the more confident they will obviously be. It's easy to see the announcements on Tuesday on staffing changes and general election footing show the seriousness and the ability to make decisions necessary to win that some have previously criticised Starmer for. Headlines have been grabbed on the Chief of Staff moving on, but the real grown-up move is the bringing back of Mariana McFadden. She's a real respected campaign pro and experienced operator. She's been brought back as campaign deputy, and the move to have one task force structure. Last time there was a realistic task force structure was 2015, and the experience and drive that they've brought in has been welcomed, and rightly so. There's also, behind the scenes, a real consolidation of responsibilities with those who understand the complexities and the potential solutions on Scotland as well. So what are the political challenges for Labour here? How do they translate that strategic need with delivering? Clarity of message, absolutely. Having a clear offer and vision and landing attacks, that's a UK-wide challenge, obviously. But in Scotland, Labour will not want to be focused on a referendum in the general election. Definitely expect lines that it's a UK general election, big chance to get rid of the Tories, it's not about the constitution. Attacking the UK government record, obviously, and campaigning on where, as Anthony mentioned before, the SNP have missed opportunities, targeting the weak spots of governing and delivery, particularly on health and education, but very much not obsessing about the referendum. And the Brown Commission, I think, is an indication of how seriously Scotland and gaining in the red ball is taken within Labour. Its potential is not just to put Scotland in a box, only on the constitution. It's about broadening out Labour's offer in Scotland and in the red wall. So takeaways from me really is that there's a real opportunity for business to engage in Scotland and on Scotland with Labour. And the principle applies across the English regions as well. obviously a big push on engagement nationally from business, but the opportunity is also there outside of London as well. And in the short to medium term, there will be new candidates in Scotland to join those selected already and are underway in England. And they could realistically be in the PLP for a significant period of time. So there's opportunities there as well in long-term relationships. And last, I would say organisationally, Labour, they're ambitious, they're adaptable, but sustained clarity of message, quick decision-making and maintaining a united discipline is really their next big challenge. So I'll hand back to Philip and Anthony to look at what this might all mean for business.
Great, smashing. Thanks very much, Fiona. So there you have a quite complex positioning for both the SNP and the Labour, and a lot to play for as we head towards the next general election. So what this all demonstrates very clearly is that Scotland will remain high up the political agenda for the foreseeable future. Consequence of that, relations between the UK and Scottish governments will remain tense. And overarching all of that, the future of Scotland in the Union will remain uncertain. So what does this mean for businesses? Both those arguing for independence and those seeking to maintain the Union will seek to co-opt businesses individually and collectively onto their side of the debate. Any interventions by businesses will be amplified, particularly as the debate hots up in the run-up to the next Westminster election. So any business with investments, employees, or customers in Scotland will need to tread carefully in what is always a fraught political environment. So I'll say a word or two about dealing with the two governments. Anthony will speak about public positioning, not least in respect of employees and customers. So any business with interests in Scotland will have to deal with both governments. Devolved powers are very extensive, and the line between what is reserved to the UK government in terms of policy and what is devolved to the Scottish government is complicated. Policy decisions taken by either government can have a big impact on ease of doing business in Scotland. Just take one example in financial services, relatively straightforward. The regulatory context is set by the UK government, but it is the Scottish government that creates the immediate business climate in Scotland through its policies on tax, income tax, notably skills, infrastructure, housing, and much else. What this means for businesses is that there is a need to understand the policy intent of both governments and, where it's appropriate, seeking to influence them accordingly. There is a subtlety to this, working with both governments without alienating the other. And that requires care, in particular, over what is said publicly. On that, over to Anthony.
Thanks, Philip. And just to add a few short thoughts, it was noticeable at the conference over the weekend, actually, as it has been for a while now elsewhere, how few businesses are really actively engaging with the Scottish government. When now really is the time to be maintaining and building relations, not necessarily on independence, as you say, Philip, but certainly on economic and business issues. And interestingly, that's something international governments might be understanding a little bit more. I think I saw as many embassy and consulate staff in Aberdeen as there were from corporates from countries like the US, Japan, Germany, France, the Nordics, engaging with ministers, MSPs, and activists. So I think companies rightly want to keep out of the political debate from an investor, colleague, customer perspective. There is little benefit in getting bogged down in public comments on the subject, and everyone on this call will recognize that workforce and customers are in Scotland are split on the subject, and there is a track record of people not responding positively to companies that have dipped their toe in the water before. But I would stress that that shouldn't preclude standard engagement in private. And in fact, the opportunities to offer up new ideas and issues on how to get the Scottish economy moving, separate from the independence debate, will be welcomed by both sides. I think two or three perspectives, just to bear in mind, the publication of the economy paper on Monday next week is really being seen by S&P advisors, by Scottish Government officials, as an opportunity to re-engage and engage more deeply with the business community. That feels more genuine than maybe it has in recent past. There's a very big drive to try and explain the economic case again and not see corporates and business leaders provide an instant reaction to some of the topics that will be included in there, like currency and regulation. So there does appear to be a genuine desire to engage on substance around both the long-term picture, but the here and now, what's working and not working in the economy. Secondly, John Swinney is covering the finance brief at the moment, whilst Kate Forbes is on maternity leave. Kate is very well thought of in the party and has been pretty proactive in engaging with business. But of course, John Swinney is the party's biggest asset for engaging with business and led that activity in the last referendum and is really a very good interlocutor from the ministerial team into business. And from a UK government perspective, the UK government is very active in Edinburgh and the rest of Scotland. They clearly want to understand what issues matter for securing greater investment and economic activity in Scotland as well as the rest of the UK. So for business, now is a good time to engage on the Scottish Government's economic strategy on economic issues in Scotland with the UK government. And for anyone with interest in Scotland, having an open relationship, constructive relationship, could prove critical for any referendum period, either during that period or following a vote if it happens.
Great. Many thanks, Anthony. And thank you to you and to Fiona for your insights into the complex politics of Scotland within the union. I hope we've demonstrated to you that this is a really important time for Scottish politics and for the future of Scotland in the union. This isn't going to relent over the next few months as we head towards a pretty critical UK general election. So it is something to keep very much front of mind wherever your business is located in the UK, because this is not just about what happens in Scotland. This is about what happens to the UK as a whole. We know all of these issues are things that businesses and investors are interested in. So I hope you found this briefing useful. Thank you very much for dialing in. As always, you know where to find us. If you've got any questions, you want any follow-up, please do get in touch. Thanks again for listening. Have a good rest of day and enjoy the weekend when it comes. Thank you very much and goodbye.